Over the first 6 weeks of the Constitutional Convention, there was really only one item on the agenda of the convention, the report of the Committee of the Whole, which was, for all practical purposes, the Edmund Randolph Virginia Plan. And within that plan, almost all the attention had been devoted to the structure of the new national legislature, whether it should have two houses, whether it should be filled by state appointment or by election by the people as a whole, or a mix of both. Connected to the question of representation, there was a parallel consideration. Should taxation follow the same path as representation in the new Congress? But that would come later, as would another bout over slavery. But for all practical purposes, the report of the Grand Committee on July 5th and the vote which finally took place on the Grand Committee's report on July 16th pretty well settled the question of what the new Congress would look like. Two houses, the lower house to be elected broadly by the people as a whole, the upper house to be elected by the state legislatures, and the authority for originating all revenue matters lodged with the lower house. This was all a compromise, and neither James Madison, who wanted everything elected broadly, nor William Patterson, who wanted everything in the new Congress to represent state interests, was entirely happy with the result. But it was a result. That result yielded at once to the next great subject lying before the convention, and that was the shape of a new national executive. And this promised to be no less thorny than the issue of representation in Congress. The great defect in ancient republics had been their tendency to decline from virtuous beginnings into complacent maturity, and finally into avarice, luxury, and corruption. As the ancient Roman historian Livy had taught classically educated Americans about Rome, republics rise or fall by what their moral principles were. As our dominion was born and grew, Livy wrote, discipline gradually collapsed, attended by a disintegration of morals. And more they slipped and slipped and finally began to fall headlong until we have reached the present times in which we can tolerate neither our own vices nor their remedies. At that point, an indolent citizenry turns to powerful executives to deal with the emergencies, only to have the executives, who liked the taste of power, refused to surrender power back to the citizens at the end of the emergencies. Americans had to think no further than Julius Caesar to understand where this led. But there was an equally unappealing executive example in American minds in the form of the colonial governors. Before the Revolution, every colony had a legislative assembly elected by the people, and a governor and a governor's council appointed by the crown in England. Only Connecticut and Rhode Island elected their own governors. The lot of these colonial governors was not, as Gilbert and Sullivan might have put it, a happy one. Their appointment came from the crown, so they were expected to represent the crown's interests. They had the power to make land grants and appointments to public office to their friends, but their salaries were provided by the legislatures. And the legislatures never hesitated to use salaries as leverage to counterpoise the authority of the crown. Fixed and stated salaries, one Massachusetts governor was tartly informed, were incompatible with our Constitution. Hence, the governors were frequently between a colonial rock and a royal hard place. In 1754, the Royal Committee of Council for Plantations complained to New York's colonial legislature that it appears from the acts of the assembly that the assembly have taken to themselves not only the management and disposal of public money, but have also wrested the nomination of all officers of government, the custody and direction of all the public military stores, the mustering and regulating of troops, and, in short, almost every other executive part of government. No wonder so many of the crown's governors actually stayed in England and delegated authority to some hapless appointee who was really only the lieutenant governor. The governors who did stay on the ground in America only made the reputation of governors worse in the 1770s by stubbornly resisting the movement toward independence and revolution. Lord Dunmore, the royal governor of Virginia, had tried to seize Virginia's cache of weapons and military supplies and incited Virginia's slaves to desert their masters and form what was called Dunmore's Ethiopian Regiment. Sir John Wentworth, the royal governor of New Hampshire, had tried to obstruct the New Hampshire militia's takeover of Fort William and Mary in Portsmouth Harbor. By the end of the Revolution, Americans wanted as little to do as possible with high and mighty executives. And doughty old Roger Sherman was not shy about warning people that an independence of the executive on the supreme legislature was, in his opinion, the very essence of tyranny, if there was any such thing. The American political climate had not been much better for governors under the Confederation, either. "The temper of the people," wrote the Revolution's first historian, David Ramsay, "would not permit that any one man, however exalted by office or distinguished by abilities, should have a negative on the declared sense of a majority of their representatives. The state constitutions, which emerged from the Revolution, when they provided for a governor at all, Pennsylvania did not. It created a supreme executive council whose members elected a president of the council. Those legislatures ensured that the governors were kept on very short leashes. 1-year terms, except in South Carolina and Delaware. Limitations on re-election. In Georgia, the same individual could only hold office for 1 year and not be re-elected for another 2. And election by the legislature. In several states, an executive council created by the legislature further limited the governor's authority. In Virginia, the governor could take no action without the advice of his council. And as we saw in Lecture 2, the Articles of Confederation were no more eager to authorize any other form of freewheeling executive. The Confederation Congress reserved virtually all government powers, legislative and executive, to itself, and only provided for, 1, a standing committee to manage affairs during Congress's adjournment, and 2, to appoint one of their number to preside, provided that no person be allowed to serve in the office of president more than 1 year in any term of 3 years. Soon enough, a Congress, which could only haphazardly summon a quorum, could not begin to handle both the legislative and executive business of the United States. So, since the Articles had also provided Congress with the authority to appoint such other committees and civil officers as may be necessary for managing the general affairs of the United States under their direction, the Confederation Congress proceeded to create superintendents for the Treasury, filled by Robert Morris, for Foreign Affairs, filled by John Jay of New York, and for War, filled by Washington's trusted old artillery chief, Henry Knox. But even then, Congress struggled to keep as many of the reins of government in its hands as possible, appointing a confusing plethora of temporary committees to act as executive carriers out of congressional decisions. James Madison summed up the problem very nicely when he said, "Experience had proved a tendency in our governments to throw all power into the legislative vortex. The executives of the states are, in general, little more than ciphers, the legislatures omnipotent. If no effectual check be devised for restraining the instability and encroachments of the latter," Madison warned, "a revolution of some kind or other would be inevitable." As Madison explained to Jefferson, any talk about a national executive was going to sharpen to a point the old fear of power jeopardizing liberty. Wherever the real power in a government lies, there is the danger of oppression, Madison said. But there is no refuge from oppression in merely emasculating the executive power and handing it all to the legislatures. Wherever there is an interest and power to do wrong, wrong will generally be done, and not less readily by a powerful and interested legislature than by a powerful and interested prince. Madison explained that there is a tendency in all governments to an augmentation of power at the expense of liberty. Power, when it has attained a certain degree of energy and independence, goes on generally to further degrees. But even when below that degree, the direct tendency is to further degrees of relaxation, until the abuses of liberty beget a sudden transition to an undue degree of power. It is a melancholy reflection, Madison added, that liberty should be equally exposed to danger, whether the government have too much or too little power, and that the line which divides these extremes should be so inaccurately defined by experience. The one notable exception to this rule about governors and executives in the early years of the American Republic was New York, where the Revolutionary Constitution, written in 1777, provided for an assembly of 70 members, elected fairly broadly by the people, and a 24-member state senate, elected only by holders of £100 worth of unencumbered property, but also for a governor, in whom was vested the supreme executive power and authority of this state. The governor was to be elected by the people, at the same time as the assembly, not appointed by the legislature. The governor would be the commander-in-chief of the state militia, and he was even granted a limited veto power over the legislature's bills. The governor's term would be for 3 years, and a governor could be elected indefinitely in New York. In fact, in the case of New York, he was, because George Clinton, the nemesis of Alexander Hamilton, had held the governorship of New York for all 10 years that the 1777 Constitution had been in effect. Not only held it, Clinton enjoyed it. He vetoed 58 pieces of legislation. He used the militia in apprehending and securing such of Daniel Shea's rebels who had fled to New York. And he masterminded both his state's rejection of the congressional impost proposal and the issuance of £200,000 in paper money. Hamilton might personally despise Clinton as a tin trumpet demagogue, but there was no denying that Clinton was a fine demonstration of what a powerful and effective executive could do. None of these examples, however, offered a very satisfactory model for the convention as it turned to the business of devising a new national executive. The seventh of Edmund Randolph's original Virginia Plan resolutions back on May 29th had called for the creation of a national executive to be chosen by the national legislature with a general authority to execute the national laws. In fact, the first debate on the subject followed almost immediately on June 1st, as the convention went into Committee of the Whole. And 4 days were spent in what amounted to preliminary skirmishing around the idea of the national executive. Madison was not, as he admitted to Washington, prepared to enter on a discussion of the executive. A national executive must also be provided, he conceded in a letter in April 1787. But he had been turning all his attention to the shape of the new Congress, and have scarcely ventured as yet to form my own opinion either of the manner in which it ought to be constituted, meaning the executive, or of the authorities with which it ought to be clothed. Others, however, were on both sides. The ebullient Charles Pinckney, whose alternative plan had been so quietly pigeonholed by Madison and the Virginians, was already prepared to call for an executive whom he called a president, in whom the executive authority of the United States shall be vested, And he took the floor to propose the creation of a vigorous executive to consist of a single person. It would not be Pinckney, though, who emerged as the chief advocate for a chief executive, however, but the bespeckled and curiously neglected legal scholar from Pennsylvania, James Wilson. Wilson was actually born in Scotland in 1742 and graduated from the University of St. Andrews, followed by further study under the doyens of Scotland's philosophical enlightenment, Francis Hutcheson and Adam Smith. He arrived in Pennsylvania in 1765 to set up a law practice in Reading, as well as lecturing on law at the College of Philadelphia. Although Wilson struck no one as a radical of any sort, Wilson began writing revolutionary justifications for independence in 1774 and served in the Continental Congress. He certainly had little sympathy with the new Pennsylvania Constitution of 1776, and it was Wilson's house in Philadelphia which became the object of the Fort Wilson riot in 1779. He was as fully prepared as Madison to raise the federal pyramid to a considerable altitude, and, together with Madison, fought a doomed rearguard action against the concessions made by the Grand Committee to William Patterson's objections. Like so many of the Confederation's critics, Wilson had been stymied by the state's erratic fiscal policies and his investments in Western lands. Yet he was no elitist aristocrat. And he denied that property was the sole or primary object of government and society. The cultivation and improvement of the human mind was the most noble object. The inevitable William Pierce thought that Wilson surely ranks among the foremost in legal and political knowledge. Government seems to have been his peculiar study. All the political institutions of the world he knows in detail and can trace the causes and effects of every revolution from the earliest stages of the Grecian Commonwealth down to the present time. Alas, added Pierce, he is no great orator. He draws the attention not by the charm of his eloquence, but by the force of his reasoning. Nor was Wilson exactly a commanding figure in public. He could never quite erase the sense of talking down to people. Benjamin Rush of Philadelphia thought that Wilson was indefatigable and confident, but also unpopular. And although he was remarked on as a tall, solid man, thick-muscled, Wilson was also inclined a little to stoutness, with a ruddy complexion, a neat white wig, and thick-lensed glasses. Wilson snatched the lead on the executive debate out of Pinckney's hands almost at once on June 1st, seconding Pinckney's motion for a vigorous executive and adding at once that it should be filled by a single person. Wilson preferred what he called a single magistrate, as giving most energy, dispatch, and responsibility to the office. Edmund Randolph, whose resolutions were the basis for the discussion in the first place, at once took alarm. His notion of an executive had not been that of a quasi-king, and it was Wilson who provoked Randolph's famous denunciation of a unity in the executive magistracy as the fetus of monarchy. Happily, Madison intervened at this moment and diverted the subject. It would be proper, he said, before a choice should be made between a unity and a plurality in the executive, to fix the extent of the executive authority, and then let that determine whether the executive should be a single person, or as Randolph preferred, a committee of three. But Wilson was ready to continue the fight over those grounds as well, arguing that the executive should be elected at large by the people, that the term of office should be 3 years, and that an option for re-election should be allowed. But especially, Wilson was determined that the executive should be filled by a national election, not by the new Congress or by the state legislatures. Experience particularly in New York, Wilson said, showed that an election of the first magistrate by the people at large was a convenient and successful mode. The direct election idea horrified Roger Sherman, even more than a single executive had disturbed Edmund Randolph. And Sherman retorted that he was for the appointment by the legislature and for making him absolutely dependent on that body, as it was the will of that which was to be executed. And independence of the executive on the supreme legislature was, in his opinion, the very essence of tyranny, if there was any such thing. But Wilson had his eye not on the past, where all the examples from British rule had underscored the corruption that flowed from kings, but on the future. If we are to establish a national government, Wilson declared, that government ought to flow from the people at large. An executive appointed by the state legislatures would always be beholden to them. An executive appointed by either house of the new Congress would likewise be beholden to them. Only appointment by the people, Wilson argued, would guarantee a national executive free of such dependence and fully in a position to check the Congress and the states from careening off the Republican track. And this was consistent, he argued, with the overall desire of the Virginia plan. He wished to derive not only both branches of the legislature from the people, without the intervention of the state legislatures, but the executive also. Wilson repeated his arguments in favor of an election without the intervention of the states several times over the following week. And just as tenaciously, critics of such an executive waved the bloody shirt of kings, including Benjamin Franklin, who warned that the executive will be always increasing here, as elsewhere, until it ends in monarchy. Wilson won at least a partial victory. The Committee of the Whole voted 7-3 in favor of a single executive, but voted 8-2 in favor of electing the executive by the national legislature for the term of 7 years. After that, the more contentious matter of Congress and representation took over, and Wilson had to cool his heels on the subject. One of the odder comments in Madison's notes of the convention's proceedings shows up at the beginning of the debate on the executive on June 1st, when John Rutledge of South Carolina animadverted on the shyness of gentlemen on this and other subjects. This shyness about debating and discussing the executive was not because members of this convention were in any way preternaturally afflicted with shyness, anything but. It was because any mention of a national executive quietly set heads turning in the direction of the man who, through the deliberations of the Committee of the Whole, sat without speaking at the Virginia delegation's table, and whom no one wished to alienate by a careless or contrary word: George Washington. From the moment the Committee of the Whole committed itself to the idea of a single executive, Pierce Butler, also of the South Carolina delegation, noticed that many of the members cast their eyes towards General Washington as president, and shaped their ideas of the powers to be given to a president by their opinions of his virtue. By the time the convention was ready to deal with the Committee of the Whole's conclusions on the executive on July 17th, the likelihood that Washington would be the first occupant of the single executive became an increasingly powerful persuasive in favor of a nationally elected president with a full array of executive powers. They ranged from a veto over congressional legislation to commander-in-chief of the armed forces. No surprise, then, that James Wilson was soon predicting that the idea was gaining ground of an election immediately or immediately by the people. This time, Wilson did not have to carry on the fight alone. James Madison had finally made up his mind that Wilson's notion of the executive was the best way forward. And Gouverneur Morris, who had been absent from the convention through the month of June and had returned on July 2nd, now became James Wilson's pit bull. The one great object of the executive is to control the legislature, Morris frankly announced, as though it had been the colonial legislatures rather than the colonial governors who had been defending the royal prerogative, and as though Morris had suddenly become not the junior partner of America's first banker, but a spokesman for the people. Morris said, "The legislature will continually seek to aggrandize and perpetuate themselves, and will seize those critical moments produced by war, invasion, or convulsion for that purpose. It is necessary, then, that the executive magistrate should be the guardian of the people, even of the lower classes, against legislative tyranny, against the great and the wealthy, who in the course of things will necessarily compose the legislative body. If the legislature elect, it will be the work of intrigue, of cabal, of faction. It will be like the election of a pope by a conclave of cardinals. The executive, therefore, ought to be so constituted as to be the great protector of the mass of the people." But not even Gouverneur Morris could overcome the resistance of Roger Sherman, who insisted that the sense of the nation would be better expressed by the legislature than by the people at large. Or the opposition of George Mason, the one Virginian who was as close to being free from awe of George Washington as anyone else in the convention. Mason conceived that it would be as unnatural to refer the choice of a proper character for chief magistrate to the people as it would to refer a trial of colors to a blind man. Not only were the people at large uneven in their capacity to estimate the worth of an individual for this office, but the sheer size of the country renders it, Mason said, impossible that the people can have the requisite capacity to judge of the respective pretensions of the candidates. So when the question was called, on direct election by the people instead of the legislature, the vote was a lopsided 9-1 against. Wilson tried to head this off by proposing a compromise. Let the people at large vote, not for a national executive, but for a group of electors on the model of the princely electors of the Holy Roman Empire, who elected a new emperor at the death of an old one. These electors, elected by the people at large, would in turn do the voting, the actual voting, for the executive. It was, as Morris described it, a mixture of the lot. And at first it passed, 6-3. Only to be reversed on July 24th, 7-4. The entire issue was threatening to sink into a bog of rancor. So Elbridge Gerry, who had chaired the Grand Committee, proposed resorting to the same strategy, the formation of a committee of detail, which would take up all of the ragged edge issues before the convention and come out with a smoothly planed set of recommendations, which would nicely dovetail with each other. "We seem to be entirely at a loss on this head," Gerry pointed out. "A committee had worked to resolve the representation question. Why not a committee again to resolve the executive question?" At the end of the day, on July 26th, the convention wearily voted to create a committee of detail and refer all of the resolutions it had adopted thus far to the committee to, as Hugh Williamson of North Carolina whimsically said, properly dress and clothe them. Then, having sat unendingly for 2 months in the humidity and heat of a Philadelphia summer, the entire convention adjourned for a week's recess, hoping devoutly that the Committee of Detail could resolve what the convention had not.